I had like 8 days in a row of the best meals I had ever had. And it changed who I was completely as a person. Someone who wanted to travel the world, to try new foods, to go to interesting places. Like it really, in 8 days, my life jumped. It's not even like I reached a fork in the road and I took the left turn. It's like something smacked me and lifted me off the road into a parallel road. It was a violent shift. Hi.
Hey. Hi. How are you doing?
Very good. What people listening don't realize is that we had a perfectly excellent intro already involving Canvas's creepy stalker staring in the background, but I suspect it is cut and they have no idea what I'm
actually
talking about.
Actually, Canvas and I were walking. We just arrived home. And it's quite nice how suddenly the weather is so cold and rainy, and I think it's a perfect way to start the show.
Yeah,
it's
it was just like
nice
boiling
to
hot,
have a little
Valley California heat, and then on a dime, it's like quote fall. LA doesn't really get that much, but you know, a single day of rain or clouds, and everyone's huddled together over like
a
flaming trash can, you know, warming our hands.
Yeah, I saw some stories on Instagram of people like just walking with their umbrellas, like it's the only time they get to use it. I actually this morning had to bring my umbrella as well just to be safe. I didn't have to use it, but yes, it's exciting. It reminds me home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, except that, you know, here we get an hour of light rain.
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course. We have 300 days of rain in Costa Rica, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
no, it's nice.
No, it's nice.
I was this past week in a combination of London and Paris, and you could definitely feel the shifting weather there.
Oh, yeah. Can you tell us a little summary of the events of this weekend?
The principal reason for my trip was to go to the premiere in Paris of the Assassin's Creed Symphonic Adventure, as they are calling it, the brand new world tour, theoretically kind of summary of the whole AC franchise in musical form. So it's a concert that starts, it goes through the whole franchise in the chronological order in which the games are set. So it starts with, you know, AC Odyssey, Ancient Greece, and Origins, Ancient Egypt, before proceeding forward into, you know, like the original AC, AC 2, Black Flag.
Right.
But anyway, so yeah, so they made this whole big concert out of the whole franchise, all the scores from all the games, all the different composers. Because Syndicate takes place in the 1840s, 1860s, it is the most recent of the games, so it became the kind of finale of the show, which was a funny surprise.
Yeah.
And Jesper Kidd, the original composer who scored the first two games, plus the two major DLCs of Brotherhood and I forgot what the name of the other one was. He was there. We had a great time hanging, as we have on these kinds of things a bunch of times before. It was awesome. Got to spend some time in London on the way. I discovered that was the easiest way to pass through customs ever. When I showed up at Heathrow and they go, "Why are you visiting London?" I go, "Honestly, it's the easiest way to get to Paris." They were like, "Okay, cool, pass along." And I was like, that's good to know for the future. No.
You damn Americans have it so easy. If I try to do that, they will arrest me.
Maybe so, sadly.
Yeah, well, my weekend, I basically just took care of Canvas and ate candy. But it was great. Thank you for asking.
We preemptively, oh, come on. We preemptively took great Halloween photos that were released onto the world while I was
To be fair, I did the pumpkin thing, which it was so very exciting and very nice to go to this like farm and see all the animals and goats and piglets, and it was very cute.
A Halloween classic.
Oh yeah, I didn't know. I was like, this is all new to me.
Yeah, they're going to the pumpkin patch to pick out your pumpkin is kind of like going to a Christmas tree place to choose your tree. You know, like Phoebe and friends working at the Christmas tree place with Joey.
Uh-huh. They also had like a corn maze that we didn't do, but we were gonna. But it was quite hot at the end of the pumpkin, you know, choosing the one mm-hmm. one to be carved. At the end, we were like a little hot. And then we decided to just come back home and do some like hot beverages and watch a little bit of Guillermo del Toro.
The Cabinet of Curiosities.
Cabinet of Curiosities. Yes. So yeah, that was my weekend. It was nice. But I'm glad you did also celebrate on your way.
Yeah, there was no real indication of Halloween there. I know that a lot of the rest of the world has started to kind of adopt it because it's fun but it's still a Halloween as it is done in the US, especially when you talk about all the candy and trick-or-treating and a lot. It's a pretty American holiday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And certainly.
And also you were like in a major city, like there's no, probably in the neighborhoods around you might see some of the decorations, but you were like in town.
I mean, I was in the heart of Paris. Literally in the most inner circle of the city. I was staying a 15-minute walk from the Eiffel Tower, and 30-minute walk, and then in London it was absolutely central London. You know, had breakfast. There was a wonderful rooftop restaurant at the hotel that looked down at the. Looked south at the Thames and you could see, you know, Big Ben and Westminster Abbey and the London Eye and the Shard and all that just straight out of the view. So, I mean, I was in the absolute heart of both cities. So you're right. You're absolutely right. It might be more of a function of the suburbs, but still, I think it's not really much of a thing in either of those two countries, at least nowhere near compared to here. So if it weren't for our photos and for you sending me, you know, your pumpkin carving, I would have no sense that it was Halloween while I was there.
You know, carving that pumpkin made me remember that I enjoy sculpting. I kind of want to get into that again.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
It reminded me the texture of your work. And I just knew this. I hope everyone goes and looks at the photos because it's worth reminding that you had never done this. And I had said, Angela is going to go and on her first try, she's going to do a pumpkin that's so superior to what most people manage. Oh. And you so proved me right, because the pumpkin reminded me of your other one and only time you did this, when you did that wood burning of the dragon and the rat.
Oh, right.
It had that same texture. It had that same look of, this isn't just like art by punching a hole in an object and relying on the negative space, which is what most people do. You actually gave it sort of multiple layers, never mind the fact that you also did the little Xeno facehugger egg, which looked incredible sort of translucent. And
yeah, it's all melted now. Since it's the first time, I had no idea how the pumpkin was going to react, and I basically layered the skin, and now that's like deformed, so I'm letting it be there, you know, dry until, you know, it can't anymore.
Yeah,
basically we're just waiting for the flies, you know, but yeah, it's decaying pretty quickly, and I had no idea it was
they don't last long. It is a very ephemeral art.
It's like sand castles.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah, it's funny. I did it as a kid, And actually, you know what? Here's a question for our commenters. I have vivid memories when carving pumpkins as a kid that it smelled horrible. When you pulled the like guts out of the inside, it was nasty and slimy, and you know, people would take all the like brains out, and you know, you could harvest some of it to make like pumpkin pie and whatever, but generally speaking, it was just nastiness that you were trying to extract out of there to hollow it out. And it, and I really strongly remember that it was a particularly awful smell. You said it had essentially no smell and it didn't bother you at all.
Yeah, it was, it does have a smell, but it's not horrible or anything. It's like basically like cutting an apple. You yeah. smell something, but it's nothing.
Right.
So maybe like my I bet that you were just carving some like bad dates.
I don't think so. This is I will be curious if anybody cares to leave a comment to say, oh no, they smell horrible. Because it's, there is a possibility, since I wasn't there, there's a possibility that you're just not sensitive to it. In the same way that there is some subset of the population for whom
I don't think so,
cilantro tastes like soap.
I was
soap.
Not alone.
Well, yeah, but there's a
what the hell?
That's a genetic thing. That there are, there's like, I think it's as many as 20% of the population has a completely different taste associated with cilantro.
I think I remember you mentioning this, and I think you mentioned on the one of the episodes actually, but
possibly.
I completely disagree.
No, I'm just saying it could be one of those situations where some percentage of the population has like a very like that smell is just awful to them.
Yeah,
but
that's
I remember
funny.
It being awful. Maybe. But I wasn't there this
well,
time.
Well, I have another pumpkin that is not open yet. Like, we were gonna meet with some. It was gonna be four people, and I bought three pumpkins. One of them bale last minute, and the other bale until the last second. So I have an extra pumpkin there.
Well, it's a bad piece of data because now it's been there for days and days, and if it smells bad.
Like, oh, come on. It's been like, what, 5 days?
Yeah, but the point is to opening them up at the same time was the only way to know for sure. Because if this one smells bad, you could easily just go, yeah, but it's been 5 more days.
True. Anyway, it was fun, and it was my first time, and I think I'll do it next year, and I'll try to get tools for it, because I basically used what I had here, and luckily I had my, like, oil knives, the, like, spatula stuff,
yep.
So I used that, but I also used a spoon and a knife, and it worked well, but I think there should be, like, special tools that I could use to make perfect and more intricate designs.
So you wanted what how would you like to introduce your topic? How do you summarize?
You already did. I was talking about the weather. How nice is to have a little change on the weather.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
changes in lifestyle, in mood, like changes with the seasons.
Changes are always good in every aspect of life.
Are always good. That's a strong statement.
Oh yeah.
Always.
Because if
good.
if you change something that you don't like, and then the result is ugly, you can keep changing until you get better results.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty sweeping. I mean, for example, you know, as I push 40, I can definitely feel my body, you know, I don't bounce back from injuries as fast as I used to, things like that. You feel if I eat a very nasty and indulgent meal, I feel it. I feel the consequences of that in a way that I didn't when I was younger. I'm hesitant to say those are good changes. They're probably inevitable changes, and it's on me to make my peace with them. So it's not necessarily bad, but I can't call them good. I mean, you remember when I stretched my back? All I did was stretch.
No,
and
I
practically
said
paralyzed
that, I
myself.
I said that thinking about personal decisions, not thinking of things that you can't have any power, you know, like.
Okay, interesting, interesting. Mm-hmm. Still, I can't help but think only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Oh, but come on.
The point.
Okay,
being,
my bad. I take that back. I'm just saying it's always good to change. It's always good to be open for change.
Oh, well, that is, I couldn't agree more. That, I think being receptive to evolving is crucial. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a classic thing you see with artists, composers, and composers in the film industry and video game and whatnot is especially susceptible to this. But even in the classical world, a classic example would be the German composer Richard Strauss, who 100 years ago, 120 years ago, was considered a radical and, you know, very, very forward-thinking, very, very kind of creatively aggressive, almost borderline avant-garde composer. And because he was the front lines of what was going on in symphonic music and in opera. And then as time went on, the world kept changing and he didn't change quite as much. And he very quickly got told, you're old fashioned, you're not cool anymore. And you know, he fell out of favor. And this, so right. That happens in Hollywood at a very fast rate. You see composers like, you know, Jerry Goldsmith, Richard Kraft, the agent who represented Jerry Goldsmith, once said that not that long ago, I asked him, what do you think that Jerry would be doing, like big Marvel movies if he was alive today? Or would he be doing more small indie kind of movies? And he said, I don't think Jerry could get hired at all in today's world. Because Jerry was even by the mid to late 90s, Jerry was already kind of becoming a grumpy old man who didn't really want to change with the times.
Which is totally fine.
Oh, come on, not this again. Never. So anyway, this idea that change, being receptive to change is so huge and so important. This is one of Hans Zimmer's strengths, I think, is never mind the fact that he has helped drive those changes. He himself has been so influential in what the changes happening are. But I think because his work, his process involves surrounding himself with composers and a whole team and everything he does is very collaborative. I think he's going to kind of always remain very connected to whatever's happening on the front lines. Especially he's always very connected with like whoever the current pop stars are. You know, like he worked with Billie Eilish on the new James Bond movie, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like I think that's kind of his MO. And whenever you're kind of staying connected with the whoever's young and new and fresh,
right.
Mm-hmm. It's harder to fall into old-fashioned territory because you're still right there at the edge. So he'll probably be forever immune because he's just hitching on. Like it's not that he's, you know, just attaching to someone else and letting them drag him there, but he collaborates with people who are fresh and new on a regular basis. So right. I think that's a great way to be, actually. It's something that I think, we should all think along those lines. Even as much as I admire the old school ways, you know, I have an old soul a little bit music. I was just messaging
I mean, it's part of being a human, you know? You have to evolve in order to be part of the society, I guess. Like, if you don't move, if you don't step forward into growth, you're just step back into safety and, you know.
Yeah, well, and as Neil deGrasse Tyson once said, if there wasn't that first person to leave the cave and go wander out and explore and see what's beyond it and embrace the danger, we'd still be in the caves, as it were. But I say all that as somebody who has I still have a very strong soft spot for in music at least, the kind of the old fashioned, you know, I've always had a soft spot for orchestral music, which is itself an old fashioned concept, but even just old fashioned kind of harmonic and melodic sensibilities. I enjoy that kind of thing. And I enjoy, you know, like Seth MacFarlane and people that relish these older styles. And I was just, shout out to, Melora Hardin, her daughter, she has these daughters that are super talented, and one of them just released a single called Love Magic that you can go find on Spotify, and she sent it to me and said, what do you think? And I was listening to it and I was like, I love that she's such an old soul. This feels like a modern production of a pop song from 50 years ago. She's like 18.
I believe there's a lot of I was gonna say inspiration, but influence from her mom.
Oh yeah, because Melora is very much an old soul musically as well. And In any case, I think it is definitely important to be always rolling with changing tides and being open to that, yep. even if I do think it's worth also having a strong foot on the foundations of things that were. In the same way that you know, you like, I see this in you as well. You love playing with tools like the iPad, the different, you know, whether it's Photoshop or the Procreate, different brush types, all the different like new tools, or even VR and all this kind of stuff. But there's also like there's an appreciation that the ability to do an ink drawing or an oil painting in the with the techniques of half millennium past great masters is worth understanding.
Even if you are, if you tag yourself in one specific area of expertise and you don't want to get out of there, that's totally fine. But I recommend to explore more areas just for the sake of experience.
Oh yeah, leave your comfort zone.
You can learn so much. Even if you don't learn anything, at least you did it and you know how it feels.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. I think composers, there's a lot of jobs that I've taken where I said, this is probably not going to be the greatest thing ever. It's not, you know, it's not the best paying ever, or it's a movie and the movie is just clearly not very good. But it's a chance to push somewhere I know I've never been, and mm-hmm. I will learn something in the process. I will grow. I'll be better.
I guess this topic comes by the hand of the comfort zone.
Yep.
Which we talked about before, but it's inevitable to not think about it. I think change is exciting and scary, but it's very exciting. It can be awesome. It can be painful, but what is more painful, to change something that you are not comfortable with, or staying stuck somewhere you don't belong or you think you're not, you know?
Yeah, and it's hard to say what's the worst fate, but certainly I think for people like us, failure to change is the worst one. And you know, it's something that I also thought of when you brought to mind this topic of just the changes, like in the context of the changing season. It's interesting how there's kind of like Russian dolls of types mm-hmm. of changes where
Matryoshkas.
I never remember what those things are called. What are they called?
Let me just Google it, just to be sure. Matryoshkas. But that's Spanish, I think. Oh no, English is still Matryoshka.
I think it's, yeah, Matryoshka.
Matryoshka. I just heard it from Google.
Ah, well, that's definitely trustworthy.
Yes.
If you think of cycles of evolution or change within us in that way of like loops nested within larger loops, this past year I have traveled a lot and it has felt like a big change because of the pandemic. The last several years I traveled almost not at all. Mm-hmm. And like when you first came to the US, we were constantly on planes traveling to, you know, Croatia, to London, to Costa Rica.
We did like 10 shows year. It was crazy.
Yep.
And then suddenly I basically did my whole 180 in my life and then stuck in the apartment.
Well, obviously it was the pandemic ground everything to a halt, and then now we have the added complication of traveling requires figuring out a situation with Canvas, and of my travel this past year has been explicitly work related, where, you know,
I think you always being work related when you travel. It's so rare for you to travel out of pleasure.
Well, but this is where it's blurry because
you love what you do.
I love what I do, and what I do is easily attachable to travel. You know, like for example, there was a concert I didn't have to go to the concert in, like, it's not like right. they called me and said, we need you to come or else the concert won't happen. They were like, if you want to come, here's the information and we'll discuss and we can put you on stage to greet the audience and sign things afterward and all that. And because I like to travel, it was like, okay, I'll be there. And then, and then I thought, you know, it's actually a little bit easier to fly to London and take the train to Paris. So I can have a, like, I was able to have a meeting while I was there. I was able to see some friends in the industry. And so it was while a I was blend there. Of so both. It's like, yeah, it's all, I'm able to write everything off because it's all business related, but it's all very pleasurable because it's quite fun. Point being, though, if you think of this Russian dolls concept, like, in the short term, I've been traveling a lot. This year alone has been some of the most travel I've done within 1 year, and the farthest travel, you know, two trips to Thailand, a trip to Australia, two trips to London, a trip to Paris. Like, it's been a pretty aggressive year for travel for me, even more than normal. And part of it feels like it's the rubber band snapping as a result of the pandemic and, like, overcompensating. Right. But then when you zoom out far enough, and this is why I thought of the Russian dolls, it's also part of just this general change and evolution within me. And the best, the poignant irony about the fact that this most recent trip was to Paris was that a trip to Paris when I was 16 is what started all of that. Because growing up, I was very much a...
You had your first trip when you were 16?
Yeah.
Out of the US?
Technically, no. We took like a family vacation to Mexico. And we also did a trip to Canada where we like rented a van basically and drove a couple of different cities. I barely remember either of those trips. Frankly, I was quite young. Most of the family trips that we took growing up would be like visiting grandparents in Texas and that kind of thing.
Right.
Arkansas. So we took vacations as a family, but it usually involved visiting or like a cousin would get married and we would go to Arkansas for the wedding, that kind of thing. I've scattered memories from growing up in that way, but I remember up until age 16-ish, you know, I liked, you know, it. I kind of stuck close to what was familiar. If I wasn't a kid, even as a teenager, I wasn't the kid to go wild, like party with my friends until 3 a.m. and get into trouble and what, like,
yeah,
me and my friends, we played games together. We played GoldenEye 64 and, you know, and LAN parties and Quake and sat there, me and my old friend Andy and Pat trying to solve, you know, Full Throttle and Grim Fandango and The Dig and,
aww,
you know, those kinds so of things. Fun. And so mm-hmm. And on top of that, you know, I was starting to get really passionate about music and I really liked putting a lot of my spare time into writing music. It was like I was obsessed. It was all I wanted to do all the time. And I remember my friend Pat, you know, it's one of my closest friends. Although ironically, we hadn't known each other that long at that point, a few years, but we had gotten really close. His parents, his dad in particular, are very obsessed with Paris and French food and gourmet cooking in general. And so they would go to Paris all the time. And my friend Pat would always feel a little kind of like, I'm kind of going along with my parents on their trip. It didn't feel like, here's a family trip. Like to him, it was kind of, you know, and I'm aware that it sounds very like ultra kind of privileged to go. He was bored going to Paris. But when you're at that age, it's more fun to be with someone your age, you know,
right.
Especially
yeah.
if you're in a foreign world where you don't speak the language, you don't know anybody.
Yeah, for sure.
So he called me and said, do you want to go over our spring break vacation of freshman sophomore year, I guess it would have been, of high school. Second year, so 10th grade. Do you want to come with my family to Paris for that week? And basically his parents and my parents made a deal where they said, if my parents covered my flight, they would take care of everything once I was there. So they would pay for my dinners and stuff. Mm-hmm. And which was extremely kind of them. And so, and they had they were renting an apartment. So like we weren't in a hotel, we were in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So Pat and I shared one room, they had a room. And so I remember at the time, I had this like crisis because I was writing this big musical work. One of my teachers was getting married and I was writing this hour-long orchestral score for their wedding. It was like my first real gig ever as a composer. And I had gotten the whole school orchestra to volunteer to play at the wedding and all this stuff. And I was banking on spring break to be like this little 7-day window of time where I had no distractions from school and could just write music all day, every day, and really kind of make sure I finish this project. Because it seemed like, how could I write an hour of music in 6 months? That's impossible. Now I have to write that amount of music in like a weekend. But so I was really, and I remember I was debating going, and I remember my dad goes, years from now, do you think that you're going to remember the music you wrote during those days, or do you think you're going to remember going to Paris? It was a life-changing thing of realizing, you know, sometimes you have to choose between, you know, conflicting interests. And that was the first time I'd ever been in the position where one of the options was basically make a memory. And my dad very wisely, strongly advocated. He was like, you'll figure it out. You can work late. You can work weekends afterward. Do what you got to do. You can't put a price on the memory of going to this trip. Not only was he so beyond right in the fact that as a 16-year-old, I got to visit one of the most, you know, noteworthy places on planet Earth for the first time, and my first time to Europe, first time crossing the ocean. I mean, it was like everything about it.
Right.
First time traveling without my family. It was like, it was a big change. But here was the crazy thing. I was also a very picky eater. I didn't really like, it was like, you want to try this? No. How about this? No. Like, I was just one of those kids growing up that knew equated to bad, and I wouldn't try things. And I would just assume I wouldn't like it. And I would even be stubborn, like, try this. Okay, fine. And then, do you like it? No, even if I secretly liked it. and so I go to Paris with this family, the dad of which is like a hardcore foodie. So, and this was before the days of smartphone. This was before the days of even like webmail. I remember it was impossible to, basically had to use like landlines to call home. That was the only way to be in touch. And so, so there was no, you know, Yelp or like.
So what, they just basically toured and looked?
Well, his dad knew everything. His dad knew all about the. You know, I'm sure there were like Zagat guides and things like that, because those go back a ways. These books that would be like, here's the top restaurants this year. They'd publish a new one each year. But his dad also just knew the scene. He knew, because these were not famous restaurants. These were like not famous for tourists. These were like, if you go down this street and turn left and then a right, there's this door that is badly lit. You go in there, that's the restaurant. Like very, very, very off the track, kind of off the path stuff. So I remember first night, I'll never forget this the rest of my life. First night, we go into this little tiny restaurant, and there couldn't have been more than like 6 tables. I mean, this is a small restaurant. Mm-hmm. And the menu's in French, you know, like this is something that France in particular does. They don't like to cater to English-speaking Americans. They're like, you speak French. You're in France. And especially back then. So the menu's all in French. I don't speak French. I don't know what any, and I wasn't particularly familiar with French food, so I didn't know what the hell I was looking at. And I go, I don't know what to order. And I remember my friend's dad goes, I brought you to a nice restaurant. Do you think I would bring you to a place that not everything on the menu is amazing? So he goes, you could choose blindly and have an excellent meal. So I said, okay, tough guy, and I literally closed my eyes, dropped my finger on a random spot on the menu. Okay, I'll have that. Thinking, this is going to suck. I don't know what I was thinking. Like, what did I win?
Or are you going to get, like, cargo? Like,
yeah, well, but does that mean I won the argument if it shows up and I hate it? Like, it was a stupid power play. But sure enough, and to this day, I have no idea what I got. But it was amazing. And the next day, did the same. Amazing. Next day, again, the same. I had, like, 8 days in a row of the best meals I had ever had, and it changed who I was completely as a person. Someone who wanted to travel the world, to try new foods, to go to interesting places. Like, it really, in 8 days, my life jumped. It's not even like I reached a fork in the road and I took the left turn. It's like something smacked me and lifted me off the road into a parallel road.
I know.
It was a violent shift.
It's so funny because you just basically changed. You went to a new restaurant and you ate, and it sounds so mundane, but it has so much power to change your life. And I keep 100%. Saying this to my sister. I keep saying this to her. Like, if you want things to work out, if you're so tired, if you're only complaining but not doing anything about it, just fucking change your attitude, because you're not going to go anywhere if you keep waiting. You know, it's up to you.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, there's no like waiting for permission or, you know, I was lucky that I had the encouragement of my dad. And I had this trip that was organized entirely by someone else as the thing that kind of pushed me out the door. If I'd had to kind of do that entirely on my own, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have just said, I want to go to Paris. Or like, I wouldn't have even been able to do that. I mean, I don't.
Right.
Like, so I got very lucky. But that's why I love telling this story to any time, like in a context like this, or when I've given talks or stuff, because if hopefully like there's that person in the audience that's feeling stuck, and they realize like it can be as simple as just trying a new food or going to a new city or just trying something simple, like go to a movie by yourself. I mean, like it can be little things. Or in my case, it was a really big thing. Again, very lucky.
Oh yeah. I had that when the day I signed up to this painting contest, I was, you know,
it's a great
same
example.
Thing happened. I basically just went for it because I was like, you know what? I always was afraid of people watching me work. Like, I don't know, like at school, if I am drawing, I don't like my classmate looking over my shoulder. I always covered what I was doing. It always made me feel self-conscious. And then I saw this on Facebook and I was like, maybe that will help me get over that feeling of, you know, just, I don't know. Let's see. Let's do it for fun. If I lose whatever, let's just see what happens. And then boom. And now, my life is completely just different.
I mean, to say the least. I mean, that makes me think of, I remember Richard Kraft, the same guy I mentioned a minute ago. Like 15 years ago, he was like, I don't know how to dance. So he signed up for dance classes, and then he entered into a dance competition and he won.
Oh my God. What?
Like a old fashioned like ballroom dance style.
Oh, that is so fun.
Yeah, it's very funny. I think that's the thing. There's no substitute to just throwing yourself into a new situation. You can't just think about it, or even just, you know, like something superficial that feels, you know, I always watch TV, but this time I'm gonna watch like a comedy instead of a horror. like there are things that we do to convince ourselves we're trying new things.
You don't know if this comedian is gonna make you feel like, oh, I should get into comedy.
Fair point. I mean, there have been a lot of times where, you know, the right exposure to something did put you on a new path. But I mean, the same could be said in my life, in starting piano lessons with Derry O'Leary when I was about 10 years old, and he introduced me to Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, that radically altered the trajectory of my life as well. I didn't even listen to music up to that point. I had no favorite band or composer or anything like that. And just this idea of evolution and change. It's funny how my sister made a comment on Facebook the other day, months ago, I think, or weeks ago. I have no idea. But she was like, when we were growing up, you know, I did this trip to Paris, but it wasn't really in adulthood. Until adulthood that I became like a traveler. She, on the other hand, very much was. And it always struck me as like, God, that sounds like an awful lifestyle. Like, I remember she would work like several jobs, you know, waiting tables and that kind of thing, and then quit them all and then go backpack from like, you know, Argentina to like Tierra del Fuego. Like, you know, just go like 6 months to South America kind of. trips or you know, Alaska for a month with just a backpack. And I remember always at the time, I just thought, oh my God, like, you know, I was always so wired for excited to be working on what I was working on that the idea of breaking away from work for that long seemed insane. And she made a comment. She was like, look how we've switched now where we are in life. You know, that she loves, you know, going camping and the things like that that are kind of like similar, but it's like for the weekend nearby right. home. And meanwhile, uh-huh. I'm like writing Facebook status updates from Bangkok. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's not like backpacking is a whole other level. You kind of like just go for the weekend or maybe just, you know, maximum a week and you're working. It's not like you're disconnected from work.
Yes and no. This is where our disagreement about kind of the defining line of what work can mean. For example, going to Bangkok and then flying up to Chiang Rai and meeting the wild boars and going to the Tom Luang cave and actually getting to go inside it and explore it and all that kind of thing. Technically, that's all connected to work, but that was just this beautiful opportunity to be at ground zero where this incredible right. story had happened. And I'm grateful that my work opened up that opportunity, but
yeah, that's very lucky.
But that's where I'm just, yeah, I'm very lucky with the kind of work that I do that it's connected to these kinds of mm-hmm. opportunities, you know?
But also it's your attitude because you can perfectly not go. You like that. You do it because it brings you experience and a lot of, you know, inspiration even.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. And the chance to try new foods and to meet new people and not just look at them like in from an Uber, you know, as they walk by, but actually meet people and talk to mm-hmm. them. And, you know, like when Troy and I were having breakfast in London just a couple of days ago, and the woman who was like the manager of the hotel came and stopped at our table because, of course, you know, Troy had already made best friends with everybody who worked there. But it's fun because then we come up and, you know, the woman is talking how she is from Spain and how she grew up outside of Madrid. And I said, oh, you know, I said, the closest I've been there is I passed through Madrid on my way to Úbeda. And she goes, Úbeda is very close to the village where I grew up. And I said, oh, funny enough, that's the one place in Spain I've been. And she was like, I can't believe you've been to Úbeda. And I was like, well, there's a big concert that happened there that I got invited to. And we were talking about how, you know, their big economy there is olive oil. And you could smell the olive trees from like 100 miles out.
Oh, wow.
It's just, there's so many of them. The air is like 50% olive smell.
Oh, my.
And yeah, it's pretty intense. So, you know, yeah, it was one of those fun things where we chatted for a bit. And, you know, that's obviously not like we sat and had a 2-hour conversation. But still, these moments where you get to really kind of connect with a person and realize, oh, you know, here's someone who's from somewhere. They've got an interesting story to tell. You know, this is an even worse example. But when we did the AC concert and, you know, people would come by and a lot of people had tattoos, including a couple AC tattoos. But I would always ask them, you know, what are some of the other stories behind these? I love to mm-hmm. have people kind of explain, oh, you know, this one was
right.
from when I was a kid, or this is in honor of my mother, or this is, you know, this kind of thing. And to me, there's just no substitute to that. You know, there's so, like, one of the best experiences ever was in Thailand earlier this year when recording for the show and having lunch, like an hour long lunch every day with the musicians where we would just sit and talk and, you know, really not just, we weren't just colleagues, you know, it wasn't just like, okay, we'll see you when the downbeat happens, but really like, let's share a meal. Let's like plan, let's like get food, plan food together. What do we want to have today? What sounds good? You know, like actually it's like almost like
KFC,
a family.
KFC, of course.
That was one of the funniest things in the world. Did I say that on here? I can't remember.
I don't know if you did, honestly, but you can do
it. Yeah, forgive me that if I'm being redundant to anybody, but the first day, they said, what kind of food should we get? And I said, get like something that's the real deal. I want proper Thailand food. And they said, all right. And then they showed up with sacks of KFC. And I was so like horrified because I thought, you got to be kidding me. And but it was different. It was like the KFC is all infused with the curries and the very traditional Thai like spices and the flavors, the chili, you know, like there's like a chili sauce. It was so good. And then I have since come to realize it's like a big thing there. And it was this recurring thing that the boys, when they were stuck in the cave, they were kept fantasizing about KFC. It's like KFC is really popular in Thailand.
That was so cute.
Yeah, it's so funny. Oh. So yeah, that actually ended up being very quintessential Thailand on my first meal there.
It's probably like the equivalent of a Mexican eating Taco Bell.
Yeah, it would be like... well, at least there, Taco Bell is like theoretically emulating Mexican food.
As far as I know, there is no Taco Bell in Mexico.
Well, there probably are, and they're full of American tourists. But
who knows? I doubt it.
It could, yeah, I don't know.
If anybody knows, please let us
know. Tag us in a selfie that you take in the Taco Bell in Mexico City.
Oh yes, if
we'll get Maluka.
I know there's people in Mexico that listen to this podcast. So if any of you guys can clarify that for us, that would be amazing.
I'll send a little note to Maluka and say, are there Taco Bells? But yeah, anyway, all examples of how we change. Mm-hmm. These are my personal examples of how we change, you know, in small ways, in big ways, in slow ways over the course of many years, or in fast ways over the course of a single dinner. Does Taco Bell exist in Mexico? This is a very important question. Let's see how she responds before the recording is finished.
You could Google that, you know? You could Google.
What's better, Google or Maluka? Malugal.
Guguka.
Oh, my Lord. Galuka. What would you say is the biggest ways in which you have changed as a result of moving to the U.S.?
I remember being in high school and kind of like not interested in learning English, but I had to because, you know, exams. I was not interested at all because I was like, what do I need this for? Like, we have subtitles in the movie theater if we need to. We have instructions, books or whatever, if we need to use a tool, and it comes in different languages and we don't need English. So I was like, so, I don't know. My mind was different back then, and my ego was too big to give, you know, to learn, to give up and learn and actually just, because I was not interested. I was like, I don't even remember if I knew what I was going to do. I guess I never knew what I was going to do. I guess until now, my life kind of like took shape. I was in denial. I was not interested at all. So even something
in your defense, let me pause you there. In your defense, I don't think it's in denial to regard the importance of English if you don't expect to live out. Like if you just assumed, if I went back in time and met high school Angela, and said, do you expect to ever live outside of Costa Rica? You would probably have said no.
I would have said no even, 5-6 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it's pride to go, this is useless. It's like, yes, it's always good to have new skills. It's hard to argue why it would be bad to learn a new thing. But it's hardly wrong to go, the odds of you needing this skill are low. Like, that's true. So I want to defend you a little bit. Like, I don't think that it made you some idiot or some jerk to roll your eyes at that time in your life. You didn't know.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. You know, like, we're young. We're kind of, like, naive, you know. We think we know everything. And
for sure.
Yeah. But no, like, we don't know. And I don't know if, like, for example, I was talking to my friend earlier today about life in general and about, you know, how do you feel? Because she got divorced, and you know, she just finished her, paperwork and stuff, and we were like, hey, congrats, finally, all done. No wait. She was telling me their situation, like he wanted to have kids, she's not interested, and then that was a big thing, and she asked me about it, and I'm like, I right now don't want any. I don't know later. I'm open because I don't know if my mind is gonna change. I don't wanna like close that door. How do you say it's a nuance? No, actually, that's not the right word. Anyway.
Well, no, I think it's the right word. It because
yeah?
It's hard to make big absolute declarations because you don't know for a fact that you'll always feel the way you do today.
Right.
Like you remain so open. You could say the odds might be 99% I never want kids, but that doesn't mm-hmm. that's not the same as 100%.
Exactly. I don't know how I'm going to feel later. I only know today that having a dog is taking me so much time of my life. And I can't even imagine what it is to have a kid. And I don't want that. Right now, I'm not interested. And I want to focus my, you know, life and work in myself. Taking care of a person for, I don't know, 20 years or whatever is not, it doesn't sound very appealing to me yeah. right now.
Yeah, that's a good example of, you know, my evolution of, I always assumed that I would want kids because I just didn't examine those feelings. I just kind of, you grow up, especially when you grow up kind of in the middle of the U.S., you know, outside of the big coastal cities, that it's actually pretty common to meet people like in L.A. and New York who don't ever have kids or don't really want kids because they live a very city life and very, you know, it's I meet plenty of people in L.A., for example, that are like, oh, no, I'm not, it's not for me. But that's much less common in a place like Colorado or the sort of suburban life of like the majority of America. Most people live relatively predictable lives. You know, that's why they always talk about that quintessential American image of the little house with the white fence and the two kids and the dog. You grow up with that imagery so universally present that it's just assumed you're going to grow up, you're going to get married, you're going to have kids, you're going to continue the tradition like all humans forever. And yeah. when you know, in my case, like moving to a place like Manhattan and then to LA and traveling, you realize, oh, there's actually all kinds of, I meet people that have kids early in life, late in life, people that have a lot of kids, people that have no kids, people that are mm-hmm. have multiple marriages and have multiple kids with multiple like spouses, you know, like kids, parents of kids where the kid was not planned. It was sort of a surprise, like all kinds of variations. So until I had exposure to all that, I grew up even into my mid-20s with this belief of like, yeah, no, I'm sure. Yeah. I'll have, you know, one of these days
right.
I'll have kids because that's expected. What you do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right. the more I was forced to say, is this a thing I really want? The more I moved the other direction of like,
right.
I don't know. I don't know that I think that's for me. My life is so all-consuming that I don't want to be a bad father, right. And it's hard to imagine being a good father unless I radically change my lifestyle. And so then I fear I would resent the kid for essentially taking that away. So it's like, well, that I don't want that either. Now, you know, this is one of those where I love my relationship with Troy because he's like, I was the same as all those things. And, you know, and he's definitely Mr. Dad now because, you know, when we were in London, he had been away from his son for over a month and it was killing him. He was really, really eager to get home. But he's still also very much the guy he's always been. As we sift through the whiskey menu at a nice bar and what, like, he's still that guy, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those where I would also agree in my case, it is not a, I'm certain I won't. I will always leave that door open, but it's something that I have great concerns over my ability to deliver quality.
Luckily, we're on the same page. As for now, we don't want any, but we don't know what the future holds.
Exactly. Change is truly a constant.
Yeah, it is just part of the evolution of humans moving forward. If you don't change, you're just stuck. I think it was bad to say it's always good to change, because it's not always good, but it is part of life. It is always good to be open to change.
The world is very dynamic, and if you try to hold yourself in place, you're very likely to get kind of left behind or burned and buried, right, kind of thing. You know, the everything is constantly changing. Oh, Maluka wrote back.
Oh my God.
She says, "Ha ha, no, we scoff at Taco Bell." Nah, we
oh,
don't.
Oh wow.
She goes. Then she laughs. She goes, "Ah, no, we don't scoff. It's just not here."
Ah, nice. Nice to know. I guess that's a better answer than Google. Googleica.
That's so my. I feel like I'm choking, and if I even try to, it's like I swallowed badly, and I'm coughing like Gulukula.
Gugukuluka.
Or Malugal. I like Malugal. That's nice. Malugal's easier.
I like it too, Malugal.
I'm just so happy that she responded before we finished recording. Anyway, apropos this, our album of the day.
Oh, yes. Changes. The album of the day is Hunky Dory by David Bowie.
Bowie.
I always say David Bowie.
Yes. Well, that's okay. Bowie. You are a tika.
Yep, nothing to say. 1971, I think it is.
Yep, I have absolutely zero trivia to offer on that one, I'm afraid.
1971, haha. Good song. Just basically because of that song, I have nothing to say about the others. I just was like, you know, that's a good song. We should just recommend it.
Talk about changes.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm on board.
You know, I also have a pet peeve.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know. It's been a while. My pet peeve today is basically people that complain about their situation, their job, their family, whatever, and don't do anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah, they prefer to complain.
Yep.
Yeah, the vindication that one feels when told, "Oh, you're right, poor you," as a replacement to actually trying to work on fixing it.
Yeah.
It's tough because, you know, there is always room for if someone needs to vent or if somebody needs to kind
but
of be heard.
If they don't do anything, like if they repeat themselves the next day and then the next week and then the next month, that's the pet peeve I have. Like,
yeah,
if
exactly.
They complain, they come to me and vent, and if you see them doing the same over and over, like, what the hell? Like, were you just wasting my time? I gave you advice. If you ask me, that's what I dislike.
Yes, I agree with the pet peeve completely under normal circumstances, but I will allow for the allowance that sometimes it's worth keeping one eye open to the idea that maybe there's more to it than the person themselves even realizes.
Right, for sure.
But I agree with you. It's not that's not me disagreeing. It's more just trying to be respectful to the small percentage of situations where it's not just somebody who likes to complain. They actually have a problem.
Right, right. Everybody's different and they deal differently with their problems, and some of them, I guess, find comfort in complaining, but some of those issues sometimes are just so superficial.
Yeah. So I never liked that kind of like classic, very cliche image of the woman who is dumped or has a shitty day at work, and the friends all swoop around and say, "We're getting ice cream and you're awesome and screw them," and that's like on Friends.
I never had that.
Like when Chandler's trying to get over Janice, you know?
And oh, yes, of course.
They're like, "This is the good ice cream kind of situation," or whatever. Like,
that's fun.
Yeah, but I always hated that because I thought, it's like, if that's the reaction of my friends, then they're showing they're not my real friends, because my actual friends would realize I want a solution. I don't want to just be told I'm awesome and to dwell in the problem.
Yeah, but I mean, just the ice cream and coming over, that shows that they care. They're sharing company and they're talking about the issue, and they're just like, if you want to bend, bend. If you just want to watch a movie and eat, just do it. like each person is different. So maybe you're kind of like encapsulating that.
Well, that's fair. That's fair.
Sometimes just company helps, you know, just being there, even if it's not talking about the thing, just being with somebody. And I'm telling you, like, that alone, it's so appreciated.
Fine. No, you're right. You're right. I feel self-conscious if I'm just complaining. And right.
Yes.
And I'm just being told, yeah, you're right. That sucks. It's awesome.
No, now, yeah, that's definitely not helpful. That some people like that. Some people like to be told you're awesome, even if it's not even true.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
I guess that's one of the things that I always feel like I'm never gonna humor you if I don't mean it.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Well, excellent pet peeve.
Yep. Here's a little quote. Unless you let go, unless you forgive yourself, unless you forgive the situation, unless you realize that the situation is over, you cannot move forward.
Who's that quote from?
I have no idea.
Well, it's related to the idea that if you want to like cross the river or cross the ocean, at some point you do have to let go of the shore. There's that always that mental image of like the one leg holding back, clinging to the dock. Yep. Or the beach or whatever, and realizing at some point you gotta let go.
If you want to fly, you have to give your weights, give away the weight, to whatever, you know how it goes.
I had it so nice and elegant, and
if you want to fly, you have to give up what weights you down. There you go.
There you go. I like that. Don't you dare cut the first draft of that statement.
I'm not. Also, Canvas is distracting
me. She's like, play with me. You've been doing this too long.
Here, I'm just going to put her... Here, you guys, you can hear her here. Just chewing on her toy. Anyway, thank you guys for being here. Send us messages. We like to read your thoughts on Twitter and Instagram, and also like emails. We get some emails from time to time, and we like to read your comments. And yeah,
love it. Bye. There you go.